the subcommittee of employee relations to order. People are going to be in and out. Unfortunately, there's, I believe the Senate has a session right now, and they're waiting for the health care bill to bounce over that we just sent in the conference committee, or to establish one. So, do we have minutes to approve?
We can approve you.
Would anybody be willing to move the amendments, or the, excuse me, the minutes from January 28th, not the amendments?
We did on a phone, right?
We did. We had six members. Representative Pepin, yourself, Representative Hillstrom, Representative Winkler, and Senator Eaton, and myself.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I don't know what the rules are on this committee, but on our regular House committees, we need to have a quorum in the room in order to transact business.
I don't believe that's the case. I'm not going to rest myself to death on being a parliamentarian, but
I want to do it right, Mr. Chair.
We had an opportunity to have I think Representative Hillstrom was actually a trainer for some of us, and I was wondering if perhaps I could ask her if she has an opinion on it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the only time that a quorum is necessary to take a vote is when someone actually challenges that there's not a quorum. So if Representative Drazkowski is actually challenging whether or not we have a quorum to transact business, then we need to wait. Are you formally challenging?
Well, I will for the rest of the agenda, Mr. Chair, but certainly the minutes may not be in place.
Representative Drazkowski and Representative Hillstrom, thank you for the input. I think given that, we'll just wait on everything and just until we get everybody here for the actual votes, and then we'll pass the minutes at that time, too. Are you comfortable with, I can still go ahead with business? Is that okay?
It's only taken a vote, Representative
Hillstrom. Okay. I'd like to invite up Ms. Holmes to tell us about the contracts that we have before us. Ms. Holmes, go ahead when you're ready. Ms. Holmes, we have a bit of a problem. We don't have a microphone for you.
It's coming.
Just 1 second, please. Senator Eaton, are you willing to move the minutes from January 28th? We now do have a quorum present in the room.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Move the minutes.
Any questions regards to the minutes from the 28th of January? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved from the January 28th meeting. And Ms. Holmes, I understand that this is kind of an exciting time for you. I'm sorry to do this. We didn't buy you a cake or all these sorts of things.
Too late.
But never too late.
For cake.
I like that. That's good. That's why I run, so I can eat bad things. No. So you're done with MMB, is my understanding?
I am moving on at the end of the week.
Well, congratulations, and thank you, really, for your service to the state of Minnesota.
And, you're welcome.
You've done good work, and Representative Drazkowski will like this, because some of it I've liked. No. You know, and but you've done great work, and thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Barbara Holmes, Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget. Several weeks ago, this subcommittee approved and the full legislature ratified 5 collective bargaining contracts and 2 pay plans that cover executive branch employees. At that time, 2 of the other contracts, we had finished negotiations and agreed with them, but they were still in the process of being ratified by the employees that are members of those covered by those two contracts. So those two groups that we have today are the bargaining unit that covers radio communications officers and the bargaining unit that covers nurses. So the first group, radio communications officers, are individuals who are part of the 9/11 public safety answering sort of system. They're dispatchers. They are within the state patrol function at the Department of Public Safety. They previously have been located in locations all throughout the state, but they're nearing the end of a consolidation process that will result in them either being located in Roseville or in Rochester, Minnesota. Currently, there are 52 members of the unit, and they are represented by AFSCME Council 5. The changes in their contract are just so very similar to the ones that you've seen before. Very few language changes, just some changes I know that I mentioned when you had the other contracts in front of you, changes to coincide with the change in statute about voting leave that the legislature passed, some changes in the federal laws that we have to make our contracts comply with. They have the same wage increase package as the other groups, 2% across the board, that is retroactive to January 2nd of this year. They have step increases that are allowed, and then they have the various changes that we've discussed previously to the insurance coverage that increases some of the co-pays and deductibles that employees will have to pay. The second contract that I have for your approval is the one, again, that covers nurses. There are 739 nurse employees. 461 of them are full-time, and the rest are of part-time status, which means less than 40 hours a week. These nurses are used in the Department of Corrections, the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, in MNSCU, in the Minnesota State Academies, in Faribault. They are on the Nursing Board, the Perpich Center for the Arts, and the Department of Veterans Affairs is where these nurse positions are employed. They are represented by the Minnesota Nurses Association. There are the language changes and the insurance changes and the wage provisions are the same as I discussed with the communications officers. There are three new items in the nurses' contract, though, that are different from what some of the other employees had. And these were proposals that were made by the state, by management, to address some of the scheduling issues that we have with nurses and to address some of the very difficult recruitment and retention issues we have with the nurses. So we've come up with a couple of what they are is they're sort of pilot projects because we put an end date on them and we want to see how they're going to work out. One of them is a student loan reimbursement pilot. And first of all, it's completely discretionary with the agency whether they want to use this with a particular employee, whether or not they have money, whether or not they have the need. But it does give the agency authority to reimburse a student loan for nurses of up to $5,000 a year and up to a maximum of $25,000 over the career of an individual. There are many details to the student loan reimbursement pilot. I think the ones you need to know is, again, they have to be here at least a year, and they have to stay for a year after they get a reimbursement. Again, the pilot project, it sunsets automatically in 2015. We'll evaluate it at that time to see how much it was used, how helpful it was, and make a decision about whether that sunset will remain in effect or whether the program will be modified or continued. We do have a new wage differential in this particular contract for what we call a charge nurse. I think many of you know that there is usually a nurse on a particular shift in a particular unit who is put in charge of the rest of them, and the agencies have the authority now to pay a wage differential of $1.50 an hour above and beyond their normal salary. We also have trouble with getting employees. We have vacancies that happen on weekend shifts intermittently because of what people's weekend activities. And when we need to get someone to cover a particular shift. If no one volunteers, we have to assign the least senior person. And what that means a lot of times is the brand new employees get stuck with the weekend shifts all the time, and we have trouble keeping them, retaining these new employees. It's a disincentive for them to come work with us or stay with us. So we have another pilot project that would, if an employee volunteers to take a weekend shift, they will get essentially $100 extra for that particular shift that they volunteer for. Again, we're going to try this out and see if this helps with some of our staffing problems. Again, these were management proposals that we made. And I would just say that all three of these sorts of mechanisms that we're doing in this contract for the nurses, they are very common in private sector situations where nurses are employed. And I think Mr. Kubinger has provided you with the cost information. I believe that's in the last page of your materials for both of these contracts, so that you can see what the new money is and what the percentage increases are in biennium and then over the biennium going into the next biennium. And they are similar to the other state contracts that you have reviewed and approved.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Any questions, Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner Holmes. Just a couple questions about the tuition reimbursement for the nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about recruitment and retention. Are there particular locations that are more difficult to retain employees than others, or is it across the board? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Mr. Chair, if I may bring someone up from the Department of Human Services who has a much better understanding about the details, and I think he'll be able to answer that question for you.
Okay. Please state your name for the record and go ahead and, if you need the question repeated, or did you have it?
I think I have it. My name is Jim Yates. I'm the Human Resource Director for the State Operated Service Division of the Department of Human Services. And maybe you could repeat the question. That would be helpful.
Was it Mr. Yates?
Yates. Yates. Y-A-T-E-S.
Representative. Thank you. Mr. Yates. My question was just, I'm wondering, Ms. Holmes talked about recruiting and retention issues mm-hmm. for nurses and hospitals having a hard time, you know, recruiting and retaining employees. And I'm just wondering if there are hospitals where this is more likely to occur, having a hard time keeping nurses, or if it's across the board, where exactly are we having a hard time keeping?
At the department, thank you, Mr. Chair. At the department, we are experiencing this across the entire state. We have hundreds of locations, or maybe 150 hospitals and other locations, and we're experiencing it in the metro, we're experiencing it in greater Minnesota. We've not discerned a difference.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Mr. Yates. Now, I was just looking at that and just wondering about how you settled on the 1 year and the amount. I know that in several different positions, I think doctors have such a program if they go and work at a location in a rural area where they're not getting paid as much, or you know, that it's harder to recruit. I'm not sure the amount of time. I know lawyers have such a reimbursement program if they go and work for legal aid for 10 years, something like that. I think teachers, if there's 5 years if they go work in low-income schools, and then they could see some of that money come back. But here I notice it's only 1 year, and I don't see any kind of caveat needed. I'm just wondering why you didn't consider in specific hospitals and critical access hospitals. I mean, I understand if you're having a hard time recruiting everywhere, but it just seems like it would be more difficult to recruit in some of those more rural areas and critical access hospitals.
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, if I can respond. First of all, it's not just for 1 year. It's $5,000 a year per employee up to a maximum of $25,000 for an employee. So you could give $5,000 1 year, the next year you can give another $5,000. So it does continue over that. And it's discretionary to the extent that if there are certain areas where we are having more problems or we feel we have to use it, that we can do it. It's completely discretionary how we use this.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chairman, so, I mean, the 1 year it says and remain employed for at least 1 year. Usually it's 5 years or 10 years. 1 year seems like an extraordinarily short amount of time, and I'm wondering if this nursing industry is having a more difficult time than doctors or lawyers or teachers. See what I'm saying? I'm just wondering why this is. I think this is probably unprecedented in the short amount of time where you'd see a return on your tuition reimbursement as a nurse.
Ms. Holmes.
And Mr. Yates can comment on this too, but I know one of the reasons that it's $5,000 per year up to $25,000 is that does help maintain and keep them if they know each year they can get it. So it's you could give it all at once when you hire them, or you can spread it out over a number of years to keep them coming back. And I don't know if Mr. Yates has any knowledge of whether or not this is typical of other loan reimbursement programs for nurses.
Mr. Yates.
No, thank you. I don't. We did contemplate that versus stay 5 years and get $25,000 or get a little bit as time went on and that. At the end of the collective bargaining process, the trade-offs, that was the deal that was struck, was you get up to $5,000 a year, but if you want, if the $25,000 is of interest and an incentive for someone, then they're going to need to stay 5 years to get there.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. And then just on some of the other provisions, because a nurse may receive a one-step increase, or if the employee is at the maximum of their salary range, a lump sum of 4% of salary, $1,500, whichever is less. No more than 35% of the nurse may receive this award. So help me understand. I mean, to me, a maximum of your salary range is a maximum. So how is it that we're paying above what a maximum of the salary range is? I see that in a few different locations. And she was walking through that. If that's other provisions, number 7, you have a maximum salary range, and then you get an additional $1,500.
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, this is the Achievement Award program, and for purposes of salary range, the Achievement Award isn't capped by that. So even if you're at the top of your range, you can still get an Achievement Award because it's a lump sum. It's not built in. It isn't a permanent increase.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry. Representative Pepin.
And then the $100 voluntary weekend shift bonus. I don't, I mean, it seems like there are a lot of industries where people, you're the newest person on the totem pole, you end up working the worst shift. So I think anybody who's worked retail could tell you that. So I'm not sure that I agree with where you're going with that one. But is it $100 per shift? If so, could it be a maximum of $200 per weekend, or what would that work out to?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it actually could be up to 3 shifts on a weekend.
So it'd be $300 per
up to 300. When we're faced with, we simply in some cases don't have enough nurses, and depending on the facility and the licensure standards, we have to have X amount of nurses depending on the size of the facility. We get in a position where we have to force people, and it's an unenviable place to be in. So, for example, if you thought you were going home at 5 o'clock to pick up your children, you might be told, no, you're staying till midnight because we need a nurse. So it avoids that. We'd rather have somebody in a voluntary situation to pick up the shift, and also in a voluntary situation where that nurse feels that he or she is safe to continue working versus being mandated to work 16 hours.
Mr. Yates, is Friday considered a weekend then?
Starting in the afternoon, because of the evening, yes.
Representative Pepin.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, maybe we should have that for legislators who are here for being here on a Saturday, Sunday, for extra $100. Huh?
I think that's called for dinner.
Yeah, that's true. I have a question.
Representative
Pepin. Mr. Chair, Ms. Holmes, on the radio communication operators contract, what is a, could you just talk about what it would be a step increase for a radio? I'm just not very familiar with that position. I understand what it, you know, if you've been there a certain amount, is it just you've been there a certain amount of time and you get a step increase?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, all employees are eligible for an annual step increase if they have satisfactory performance up to the max of the salary range. So it is similar, it is exactly the same as in the rest of the labor contracts.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Chair. Back to the nurses, some places have shift differential. Is there shift differential for evenings and weekends?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, yes, there is a shift differential provision in this contract, and it is 5 cents per hour.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Holmes, so this $100 is in addition to the shift differential?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the shift differential, again, covers, yes, certain hours. And if they work on a weekend and their shift includes those certain hours, yes, they will be getting a shift differential and also this $100 bonus for the volunteering for the shift.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I know we're having some workforce issues in nursing. This gives a great deal of discretion to the appointing authority. How are we going to control this so that it's targeted to where there is the greatest shortage? Hospitals have shortages all the time. I understand that, but for example, correctional facilities are having a big struggle. They're probably going to have a harder time than a veterans hospital or veterans home. I'm sorry. So, is there anything in this contract that helps focus this spending on where it's most needed, or is it just first come first serve, or is it unlimited?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, it is within the agency's discretion. They have a budget. They have to live with that particular budget, and they're going to have to make their decisions on how they staff and where they spend this money. And the other thing is, it's difficult to put a control in a labor contract when you're covering the diversity of agencies and situations that these nurses are used in. I mean, we use them in everything for the sort of direct sort of nursing care to patients, to we have nurses that we use to evaluate facilities. We have public health nurses. So it is going to be up to the agency. And again, that's one of the reasons we did put the pilot language in there, so that we can take a look at it again and see where it's used and how it's being used.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the indulgence. I'm trying to, looking at the settlement sheet, is this financial provision, items 1 through 5, is that included in the total amount that we see in the biennial tails, or is that somewhere else?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, those items are not included in that because of the discretionary nature of it, because of the newness of the provisions. We're going to have a track record of some sorts to see how frequently these are used.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Holmes, is there a cap?
Ms. Holmes.
Is there a cap on
the total amount spent on these financial provisions 1 through 5?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, there is a cap on the student loan reimbursement of $25,000 per person, but overall, no, there isn't a cap. The cap is what gets appropriated to the agency to run their agency.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to wrap my head around. Okay. So.
Do you have another question, Senator?
No.
Oh, okay. Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations recommend the following negotiated agreements entered into between the exclusive representatives of the state bargaining units and the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget be ratified by the legislature. Agreement with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5, Unit 225. Agreement with Inter-Faculty Organization, and the agreement with the Minnesota Nurses Association.
Okay, thank you, Senator Eaton. So we have that SER 1 before us, and I think we're going to need to hear from the faculty folks. Is there some more questions? I'm sorry. You don't get to leave yet. So, Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question would be for Ms. Holmes. Ms. Holmes, we had for both AFSCME and MAPE, and I asked Mr. Huben to report, and I think he's compiling it. Maybe you have this information. Do you know what the step percentages represented for both 2012 and 13 are for each of these two organizations?
Yes, I believe.
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe it's in the memo, the step percentage. I believe it's 2.7 for radio communication officers, and I think for nurses it is a 4.0 step increase.
Mr. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. I didn't know if that's what that represents, but you can confirm that for me. Thank you. Contract to contract, these contracts compared to the 10 and 11 contracts, did the steps change at all?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, no, the amount of the step increase for every contract that you have seen, it has not changed.
Okay.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question might be from Mr. Yates. I've got a sheet that lays out average annual salaries of each of the bargaining units, and it's got Minnesota Nurses Association average at $72,433. How does that compare? That seems like a lot of money. How does that compare with the rest of the nurses in the private sector?
Ms. Holmes or Mr. Yates? Have you added?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, your question was how does that compare with the private sector? In general, we are lower than the private sector with the contracts that the Minnesota Nurses Association has negotiated with the Medford Hospitals, for example. We tend to be notably lower in overall rates of pay.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested in seeing those numbers because the $72,000 and then about 30% for benefits, and you're approaching $100,000 a year for a nurse. And I guess nurses are expensive, and I know that the demand can be high in certain localities, but where I come from, that's a pile of cash. I guess this question is for Ms. Holmes before she leaves the table. Ms. Holmes, where are the with each of these two contracts and the, I think it was four or five that we passed last time, where are the contract negotiations? Have we started another set of negotiating rounds for the 14-15 calendar years, or could you give us an update on that briefly?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we have one contract that is being voted on right now. The Minnesota Government Engineers Council contract is being voted on and will still have to be brought before you. And then we have one contract with the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association that we have not resolved. And so those are the 2011-2013 contracts. We have started the process internally on proposal development for the next round of negotiations in terms of my staff meeting with human resource directors and other members of agencies to look at proposals for next time.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Holmes, what is the best guess or estimate in your mind now of when the negotiations for the 14-15 calendar years may begin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I have to confess that my leaving has caused a little bit of delay in it, in terms of either getting someone in my place or the scheduling. But I would imagine we have not set the opening dates, but we are looking at probably the end of April. I think we're going to be able to be back on track with the settlement of these contracts so that we have the two major contracts, the AFSCME and MAPE contracts, completed before July 1st.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's our intent.
Thank you.
Okay. And I'm hoping that Ms. Holmes will continue to be here, so if you have further questions, I'm not going to stop that. Senator Eaton.
Hi, Ms. Holmes. Do you, in the nurses' contract, are the APRN still in there?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, yes. Senator Eaton is referring to a classification of advanced practice registered nurse, which are the, I think, colloquially, it's the nurse practitioner, and they're very high-level nurse. They're very, they're very close to a lot of the duties that they can do and authority they have to medical doctors, and we're using them quite frequently because they are less expensive but as capable as medical doctors in some of our facilities. And they do get a higher salary than a registered nurse, as we probably think of them. So that does pull up that average salary a bit.
Otherwise, I shouldn't have left the state.
Well, thank you. So we'd like to invite up the folks from Mr. Dale from Minskew. Go ahead, state your name and
Chairman,
when you're ready.
My name is Chris Dale. I'm Senior Assistant Director for Labor Relations for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I was the chief negotiator for the Minskew system with respect to the contract with the faculty organization.
Can you tell us?
I will.
Okay.
Go ahead and tell you a little bit about the contract. We reached a tentative agreement with the IFO that they're having on January 12th. And the summary has been provided to you by Mr. Hubinger, but let me just summarize the more significant items. In terms of economics, in fiscal year 2012, there are no step increases, no salary schedule enhancements, and no other compensation provisions changed in the agreement. We did continue to provide professional improvement and professional study travel funds at the same rates that were provided in fiscal year 2011. In fiscal year 2013, we provided for a one-step increase for faculty members returning in the unit who had served during fiscal year 2012, and we provided for a salary schedule enhancement of 2.2%. We provided a similar increase to our adjunct faculty, which in terms of dollars works out to a change from $1,200 per credit to $1,258 per credit. You will find that the adjunct faculty are paid considerably less than our regular full-time faculty. They're not expected to complete the wide range of duties that full-time faculty would complete. They just provide instruction. The fact that the salary change is relatively modest. We also provided an increase for assessment of prior learning. This is a function that faculty serve when they take a life experience or other related experience. And can provide college credit for that. We envision a growing need for this type of service and these types of assessments, and the current rate was well below what we believe to be the market rate. So we moved that from $18.50 per credit to $35 per credit. We provided a lump, this is a little bit of an unusual feature, but we provided a lump sum payment for faculty members who take unpaid parental leave in whole semester increments. And this was the result of some negotiations back and forth, but the point here is to try to provide some sort of lump sum payment for new family, faculty members who are new family, have new family members, and who are on unpaid leave, and can use that money perhaps to cover the cost of COVID insurance benefits or other benefits that they have. We increased the minimum step placements for our assistant associates and full professors. And, of course, we agreed to the insurance package that was agreed to with by MMB and the classified units. There were a few significant language items that are, I think, worth mentioning, and you may have questions about other language items. But let me just highlight some of the more significant ones. With respect to our adjunct faculty, we replaced the current sick leave provisions that provided for accruing sick leave. Much like your regular employees, with just a paid an opportunity to miss up to two days per semester without loss of pay in the event of sickness, and that type of leave does not accrue. Sick leave accrual had proved to be a very problematic issue for us with respect to these very part-time faculty, and both the accrual rates of accrual and the rates of usage. And so we try to get out of that business and move to just something akin to a PTO but it's not accrual, and it's just 2 days per semester. We did something similar with respect to the personal leave provisions, and we just simply provide 1 day of personal leave per semester, as opposed to the 3 days per year we provide to our regular faculty. We had a series of modifications that allowed us to implement more fully and without, I think, a lot of local questions regarding our 9-month appointments, which we had negotiated a new appointment type during the 2007-2009 negotiations, and we believe these will end those questions and provide some additional flexibility to clarify the use of the 9-month appointments with respect to the senior year, ensuring there will be a 9-month actual appointment during the course of the fiscal year so that the faculty will receive their insurance benefits without additional questions. And finally, we made some changes, some of which are just structural, but others are actually substantive changes to our professional development evaluation process, which incorporates the establishment of program goals and objectives, changes the structure of the evaluation article in our contract, and clarifies that our departments will provide feedback with respect to professional development reports at the culmination of the evaluation process at the end of the year. And that will answer a lot of questions with respect to those items, and we believe provide for a more an evaluation process that is more closely aligned with the actual work being done by the faculty members and their disciplinary specialties.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dale. And any questions for Mr. Dale? Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, item number 4 on the sheet on page 3 on the bottom talks about the $1,500 lump sum payment for faculty who take unpaid parental leave. And I heard you say a little bit about that. I'm wondering if you can expand on that. So right now, those faculty, for some reason, take unpaid parental leave. They opt in to do that. It gives them flexibility in their families. So now we are paying them for unpaid leave. Is that what we're doing?
Chair Lilly and Representative Draskowski, that's not quite right. Currently, faculty members may take paid leave, and they're not obligated to take it in any particular increment. And so faculty members may, of course, that type of leave is protected by the Family Medical Leave Act as well. And they may choose to take that in increments that do not align with our semesters. And if faculty members come back, then they have a right to return. If they choose to come back before the end of a semester, we have no choice but to put them back to work. But we may not have classroom work for them. So what is going on here is both addressing a need that we have, which would be a desire if folks are going to be gone for the majority of a semester to be gone for the entire semester, so as to save us the expense of wages and benefits during that portion of the semester that might otherwise return. And it meets also a need perhaps of the faculty who would like to take their unpaid leave to do the parental bonding that this leave is designed for, and perhaps be able to cover more effectively some of the costs of COBRA insurance, which they are being charged for during the time they elect to take COBRA coverage.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, I think I followed you, but to not get in the weeds too far, that's apparently the leave right now is called unpaid leave, is of a longer duration than the paid leave. Is that accurate? The unpaid leave spans at least a semester? Is that?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, the unpaid leave now is not for a specific set duration.
Representative Draskowski. Mr. Dale, you might need to.
Okay.
Yeah, if you can paint a picture for me, Mr. Dale, how does unpaid leave and paid leave, as they're called now, how do they relate in their duration and so forth?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski. Currently, we do not provide paid leave for faculty members who wish to take leave for purposes of bonding with a newly born child or a newly placed adopted child. What we do provide, and of course what is required by the Family Medical Leave Act, is unpaid leave. And we provide unpaid leave of longer duration than is required by the Family Medical Leave Act, because the Family Medical Leave Act requires a leave of 12 weeks with the promise of a return. We provide leave of greater lengths than that. But currently, there is nothing that requires a that new family member who is our employee to take the leave, the full 12 weeks of Family Medical Leave Act, or to fully exhaust the unpaid leave that we offer so that they would be gone in full semester increments. So the fact is that one of the major factors that dictates when a faculty member might return from the family leave is how long they can afford to be out on the family leave. And for our purposes, we would prefer to have faculty who take the bulk of a semester off to take the entire semester off. So we would prefer to avoid faculty coming back partway through the semester, and if that requires a $1,500 lump sum payment to induce them to take the entire semester rather than coming back partway through the semester, it seems like a reasonable trade-off to us, because if they come back partway through the semester, then we have to pay them their wages and benefits, and they may not be able to go back into the classroom at that point because they've been out of the classroom so long another faculty member has had to take over that class and deliver that class. I mean, it's unwise. You wouldn't want to switch the faculty right at the end of the semester like that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gale. That was helpful. Thank you. The question I have, and you don't have to answer this question, I'm just wondering if a $1,500 lump sum is going to actually induce them to go longer. I mean, if you're there for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, you're gone, rather than 12 weeks or 16 weeks, it's still the same $1,500. I mean, if I was there, I would say, you know, and I was going to take that, I would say, well, it would be running through my mind, natural as human nature would induce me to think, I would start to wonder what is the minimum amount of time that I can be on paid or unpaid leave and receive the full $1,500, and that would be my starting point, my negotiation with myself and my family. So, again, not a question for you. I question whether it's going to do what you are asking it to do. But the question related to that one is, do you have some sort of evaluative in place so that when you get to the next contract negotiations and you look at that particular item, you find out if it really worked or if they thought like I did?
Mr. Dale. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. Well, we didn't establish criteria, but we did take a look at what our experience was over the last 3 years before we agreed to this proposal. We believe we'd be able to compare subsequent years, our experience with those subsequent years, to see if it's working. I think it's a fair question that you've asked as to whether the $1,500 is enough to induce somebody who has the option of returning, let's say, with 5 weeks left in the semester, and collecting one-third of a semester salary, essentially, whether $1,500 would be enough to induce them to take the rest of that semester off. And I think the calculus that goes on is less what is the minimum time that I have to take to get that $1,500, and more what is the maximum amount of time I can take that I can afford. Because most of the faculty who tend to take a salary are newer to us in their careers, and that suggests that they're typically not at the high end salaries. So those are folks that are not making a tremendous amount of money and haven't had the time to accumulate savings to bridge that gap, that 12-week gap or that 15-week gap that is essential.
Mr. Chair,
is that it?
I've got one more question.
Yep. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dale. So, I would suggest you might want to look at it in the future, so that to take a look at how that's structured. I mean, if you're going to want to have people run the entire duration of whatever your goal is, whether it's 12 weeks or 16 or whatever, you may want to break the $1,500 into quarterly increments or every 2 weeks or whatever that number is. And then it wouldn't appear to people like me who look at some of this stuff critically and as an entitlement. The second question, last question I have, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dale, is number 3 on the same page right above that. We're establishing a new minimum steps on the salary schedule for professors, associate professors and assistant professors. Can you tell us more about this, and is this going to create compression for everybody else all the way up the pay scale?
Mr. Dale. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. Well, I can tell you more about it is that we had adjusted our salary schedule so that we didn't have the minimum steps for the assistant professor in 2008, in July 1, 2008, was the last time we had done that. What we took a look at was the relative competitiveness of our salaries versus all public four-year universities, public and private four-year universities, with data available to us from IPEDS, and it was fairly clear that we were suffering a certain amount of deterioration over the last 4 years, and particularly in the full professor ranks. And there are a couple of different ways of approaching that, of course, is that if you want to be in a competitive position, that is, we had fallen below the 50th percentile with respect to our full professors. And there are a couple of different approaches one can take, and what we tried to do here was to take a multifaceted approach, which was to negotiate the types of increase that we thought we could reasonably afford and were consistent with the other increases that had taken place, and to try to assure that the lowest salaries for our full professors, if you were going to achieve that rank, would not be too low so as to drag down our average salary for the full professors. So that was the thought process on that. And the other part was is that it was a negotiation, and we tried to keep these reasonable welts because we were certainly asked for a more significant minimum step movement than we agreed to.
Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gale, the last part of that question is, do you believe or have you looked at the propensity for this to develop compression all the way up the pay scale and require additional money from the legislature in the future because of this?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raskowski, we do a salary a review process with our faculty. We're actually a little bit behind, I'm sorry to say right now, but we do every 5 years we do a multiple regression analysis, and one of the things that we have taken a look at is salary compression. And we did not have, the last time we looked, a salary compression problem. And we were actually pleased about that. But it does not mean we'll ever have one in the future. But we will take a look at that when we get ourselves finally into the position to complete this next study. And we do not expect this to create a salary compression problem. And there are certain steps that we can take after we complete the study, perhaps, if there is a salary compression problem, to address that. But we don't believe that will create a salary compression problem.
I think so, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question, Mr.
Yep. Representative Raskowski, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Dale, you know, and I appreciate that. As these come forward, and you would hope, and as we look at the amount of money that we are talking about with taxpayers here, that your organization and others, as they come to this point in the negotiations, would have at least looked at and modeled what these things are going to do. I mean, we're creating a new policy here that at least appears that it could have that effect, and it would be good to know it didn't, because the consequences, if it does, could be huge. And once you do something here, it's hard to undo it. That's been my experience. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Gale. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I'm sick. Mr. Gale, I'm just looking through the interfaculty contract, and it seems very generous to me. 2.2% across the board increase. A step represents a negative step increase, 2.4% increase, which seems very generous to me. And then on the next page, number 6, I see that faculty reaching 10, 20, 30 years of service continue to receive career steps equal to 2 steps of $4,800, and the sunset date for this provision is deleted. So I guess my question would be, what would be the dollar amount to that then, if they're getting a step increase, they're getting an across-the-board increase, and then 2.4%, do you have an average of what that would be dollar-wise for both the one-step and the two-step?
Mr. Dale, how's your math on the fly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I do not have an average for what the dollar increase would be for the typical faculty member It would depend on what step they were at. Our steps are remarkably consistent. They are all almost exact, slightly under 2.4. They're 2.4% apart, all of them. So it's a very consistent progression. And they do receive, as you have pointed out, returning faculty will receive one 2.4% step increase. That is the first increase that our faculty have had since fiscal year 09. I think that the generosity of it has to be evaluated against the prior 3 years in which they did not have those increases, either step increases or schedule enhancements. But it is true that we do have these career steps. They are actually a product of our multiple regression analysis that we did back in 2002 when it did indicate we did have a salary compression problem. And we negotiated those, and they have helped largely alleviate that salary compression problem. At least that was the indication from our 2006 multiple regression analysis. We are going to be doing another one, and we believe that we will continue to not have a salary compression analysis problem. But we did agree, as you pointed out, to leave that sunset. At the same time, that was part of the negotiated package that allowed us to eliminate the traditional sick leave benefit that our adjunct faculty have had and move to the more like a paid time off benefit that does not accrue for our adjunct faculty, which was, I think, the product of adding the adjunct faculty to the bargaining unit after the sick leave provisions originally had been bargained back in the 80s. And so we felt that was a fair trade to try to get to move away from the traditional sick leave with our adjunct faculty.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dale, thanks for being patient with me. I'm new to this committee. But so why the 10, 20, and 30 years of service? Why those particular...
Mr. Dale, and I'm guessing you could provide the numbers that she asked for earlier to off at a later time or something.
Mr. Chair, for Representative Pepin, yes, I think we could. It's not something we would normally calculate, but we could try to do that to figure out what the average increase would be. The 10, 20, and 30 years was a product of a negotiated agreement, and it was just an effort to try to provide at reasonable time intervals some additional compensation to address the effects of salary compression, but not to string it out so long as to promote people extending their careers artificially just for the purpose of collecting an additional step.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Well, it seems very generous to me, but I do have an additional question. A number 8, faculty who give 1 year's notice of retirement continue to receive a two-step increase in their final year of teaching. And then it has more information. If a faculty member is at the top of their salary range, they receive a lump sum of $4,800. What's the point of this, and does that have an impact on, does that have an impact on pension, or what is that all about?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. Well, this was language that was negotiated in the contract. It has been in the contract for some time. My understanding, predating my actual employment at Minsky, but my understanding is that this was negotiated for the purpose of trying to assure that we, the colleges and universities, will always have notice that a faculty member intends to retire, because the search cycle for faculty tends to be much longer than your typical employee, and you try to align it with the academic year, the traditional academic year, and commence those searches so that you are able to recruit and actually hire quality faculty in a timeline that matches the normal hiring cycle for those folks. So that was what it was intended to do. It does work. You are correct that it does, in fact, impact for those faculty who are in the defined benefit insurance retirement program. It does impact their high five.
I'm seeing some shaking heads out in the audience, but I don't know if you care to comment, or is that not true, or just leave it alone? Okay. I'm sorry. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Dale, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dale, thank you. And that was what I was wondering. Of course, I was worried about what the bottom line is. So it sounds like, you know, apparently there's a real recruitment issue in this field. Is that, I see a couple other things in there that are seem like extremely generous benefits, including number 14, tuition waiver for faculty, 30 credits per year that could go to member spouse or dependent children. And then also number 15, faculty who are 55 years old and have 10 years of service may work between a third and two-thirds time and receive insurance for retirement benefits as if they work part-time. I mean, that seems extremely generous. Is that, you know, is the situation that dire, or just trying to understand that?
Mr. Dan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I want to qualify and say that I would need to, when you mentioned that they were shaking heads, I realized that Mr.
Stanton... I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that to you, but I...
Mr. Stanton is out there in the audience. And as I think about it, I'm not certain that actually those two steps at the end are considered part of the salary for purposes of the insurance, so I would have to check that and verify that for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dale, and again, I'm sorry for, my handling of that.
That is a fair thing.
I just continue to have all these... fun things, right, Representative
Pepin?
Please answer a question.
With respect to the questions concerning the phased retirement of the annuitant employment program, those are statutory programs that are set forth in statute currently, and they are reflected in our contract, they only incorporate the actual terms of the statutory provisions, and they can be changed by statute. We, of course, have to change our contract to reflect those changes. The programs are discretionary from the perspective of each college or university. You do not have to agree to these, and I think it is a fair assessment to say that it can be somewhat more expensive to continue delivering a program with a part-time faculty member who's getting full-time benefits. However, that has to be weighed against the alternatives, where sometimes you are facing the choice of somebody separating completely and no longer being able to provide the services that they provide. This can provide an opportunity to transition those programs or disciplines, transition to hiring somebody who can help meet the needs of the program. And while the current faculty member phases into retirement, so it is true that it can be somewhat more expensive per credit for that particular faculty member to deliver to continue to be employed by us. But the state universities involved don't have to agree to the retirement or annuitant employment program proposal made by the faculty member.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dale. I think that I have a pretty good understanding of this all now. I'm wondering, though, Mr. Chair, if I could either from Mr. Dale or Mr. Stanton? I would like some more information about the effect of the HIFI and what the impact, what kind of an impact that would have, if that's available at all.
Mr. Stanton, would you be willing to come up and please state your name for the record and who you represent?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Russ Stanton, Interfaculty Organization. It is not included by TRA in the HIFI salary. We certainly want it to be included, but they always refuse. They consider it a severance benefit, and severance is not included in the HIFI salary.
Thanks. Representative Pepin, we'd accept that as a friendly amendment.
Yes.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Dale.
Are we allowed to amend?
Oh, she's good. Before you go, I have a question. I was wondering, I noticed there's a professor out in the crowd from Century College, and how is Century to deal with in the negotiation? Are they competent staff at Century? Or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this contract actually does not involve faculty at Century College. That's a two-year college, and that is the Minnesota State College Faculty Association. I assure you they're very difficult to negotiate with. As our
Thank you, sir. With that, Senator Eaton renews her motion that SER 1.
Can I suggest a technical amendment?
Yes.
Senator Eaton's resolution. Paragraphs A, B, and C refer to the subcommittee receiving these agreements on March 7th, and we do, because of the delay in the schedule of this meeting, we actually got them on March 11th. We could incorporate that change, that'd be clearer.
Are you willing to incorporate that? Great. So, Senator Eaton renews her motion. Representative Draskowski.
Mr. Chair, a quick question for Mr. Dale.
Mr. Dale.
First of all, I'd ask for a roll call on the motion.
A roll call has been requested and will be granted.
Mr. Dale, we asked this same question of the others last August, and I would expect the answer to be the same to the other contracts represented here earlier. But the question is, in your deliberations and negotiations, did you take a look at private sector salaries? What has happened to them over the last several years or decades, their trends, comparable positions in the private sector and where they went, certainly those of us that know the private sector. And the rhetorical question for you would also be, has your unit ever experienced a salary decrease? And I think I know the answer to that, so you don't need to answer that one. But to what extent did you compare or look at private sector data in your analysis as you began to enter the negotiation process?
Mr. Dale. Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski. As I mentioned earlier, we actually did do an analysis with IPEX data, comparing ourselves, our own faculty at the state universities, and our college faculty with at each of the relative rank, the ranks that we offer, instructor, assistant professor, associate professor, and full professor, with all public universities and then four-year public universities and all public and private combined. And we did not separate out the private separately. And the fact is that our relative position had deteriorated in the last 4 years, which was not unexpected because we actually hadn't had any pay increases over the last four years. And we know from data from CUPA, the College and University Professional Association, that median salaries for faculty have continued to rise during that four-year period. Most recently, with fiscal year 2012, CUPA just reported that median faculty salaries went up 2.2%. So we were aware that our position had deteriorated and had deteriorated sufficiently enough with the full professors, as I mentioned, that we were actually below the 50th percentile. Not a terribly competitive position, but we did not segregate out the private separately for purposes of that analysis. We compete really in a national market. We do have to compete with what I would call, what they used to call, I think, Carnegie Category 2 institutions, which offer, or comprehensive institutions, which offer master's degrees in some programs, but are not like the University of Minnesota, a Research 1 institution. So that's who we see the relative market with, and that's who we compete with.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Representative Draskowski?
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Yep. Chairman. Mr. Dale, so it sounds like you compared to academia, and to an extent, at least a slice of one of the pieces that you compared with was private institutions, although it wasn't segregated. But do you ever look outside of academia or, look at what engineers in the private sector and what their trends are doing, what... people with math degrees have in the private sector, English degrees, et cetera, or is that unprecedented?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I'm not aware of any tradition of any experience of folks who are trying to make assessments about where to place college or university faculty looking at non-faculty positions. With respect to the engineers, I'm confident that our engineers would like us to look at where our engineering faculty would like us to look at where private sector engineers are placed in the market, but I think we would resist doing that. But it is fair also to say I suspect that our college professors who teach English are happy to have a full-time regular income, and maybe that's not true of everybody else out there with an English degree like myself.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, I just thought of one final question. I'm looking at all the different possible ways to get step increases, and so my question is, what is the maximum possible number of step increases one employee can get at a time, and what would that amount for percentage-wise? See what I'm asking you?
You're asking me the hypothetical, what hypothetically a faculty member...
If you added these different things together.
It is possible. I don't know that there's anybody who has actually in this position, but it is possible that a faculty member who's returning this year could get their return step and could be at a 10-year threshold and could have experienced a promotion at the same time. And so conceivably they could have gotten five steps.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
And Mr. Dale, and what percentage of increase would that be?
That would be approximately 12.4%, I believe.
And that includes across the board increase as well, Mr. Dale? Is that just the step increases?
That's the steps, but the steps have the new 2.2% salary schedule built into them. So it would have been, I guess it would be fair to say that does not have the 2.2.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Dale, so the maximum then would be 14.6%?
Is that Mr. Dale.
Hypothetically, I think that would be the maximum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale.
Seeing no more questions, Senator Eaton, we use your motion that SCR 1 be approved as amended. All those in favor? Oh, roll call has been requested. Mr. Huinger, will you call a roll? The chair.
Representative Hood?
Aye.
Representative Draskowski?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Senator Benson?
No.
Senator Chamberlain?
No.
Senator Eaton?
Aye.
Senator Metzen?
Yes.
Senator Saxog?
Yes.
SGR 1 passes 6-4. I'd like to invite up Ms. O'Connor and Ms. Richards. And Representative Winkler will move SGR 2.
Mr. Chair, you could make the same correction to change March 7th to March 11th.
And incorporate that change.
So Representative Winkler has moved the SAR 2 as amended, and go ahead and state your names for the record, and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Diane O'Connor. I serve as the Deputy Director at the Office of Higher Education.
My name is Lynn Richard, and I work in Human Resources at the Office of Higher Ed.
All right. The Office of Higher Ed is a rather small agency of 65 full-time equivalent employees. We provide students with financial aid programs and information to help them gain access to post-secondary education. The agency serves as the state's clearinghouse for data, research and analysis on post-secondary enrollment, financial aid, finances, and trends in higher ed. We administer the Minnesota State Grant Program, as well as overseeing other state scholarship programs, the Tuition Reciprocity Program, and a student loan program. We also do licensing and registration of private higher ed institutions in Minnesota. MMB is required to review and approve our plan. We've met with MMB to discuss our compensation plan, and we followed their recommendations. What we are proposing is within the limits of compensation plans that have been approved by MMB. The salary increase proposed and benefits such as health and dental insurance, medical and dental expense accounts, vacation, and sick leave mirror the managerial plan. We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
So that this impacts 45 employees?
45.
43. Okay. That are covered by the
Representative
Winkler, do you have a question? I thought I saw your arm.
It's not. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Deadline, we have got involuntary twinges.
We play hockey together, so I see his arm move.
He hasn't broken my arm yet.
I think that means pass. So sorry about that. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. I'm just wondering, can you walk me through number two? On the sheet here, it says, performance-based increases beginning retroactively. Employees may receive these performance-based increases up to 3.5% each calendar year. Maybe you already said, how did you settle on that number? That seems higher than the other.
Mr. Chair and Captain. This These performance-based increases actually reflect what is in the managerial plan, which has earlier been approved by your body.
Representative Pepin.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have other questions. Questions?
Fantastic. With that, seeing no more questions, Representative Winkler moves approval of SER.
Could we get a roll call?
Roll call has been requested to grant it. Of the SCR 2 as amended. Mr. Huebinger will take the roll.
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Blaskowski?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Senator Benson?
No.
Senator Chamberlain?
No.
Senator Eaton?
Yes.
Senator Metzen?
Aye.
Senator Saxon?
Yes.
SCR 2 as amended is approved 6-4. Thank you very much, you folks. And again, Ms. Holmes, thank you very much for your service to the state of Minnesota. I hope you have happy trails. Where it brings you. I got to give her credit. She brought homework when she was before Mary Murphy's committee. And as we all are required to do at different times, so she's good support. Thank you very much, members. And with that, we are adjourned.